This is the West Enterprise Center Start and Grow Your Business podcast. Our guest on this segment is the executive director of a unique supported living program called Great Livin'. Entrepreneur Matt Pohl co-created the company Great Livin' with Stephen Nadolny, and he joins us on the line now from their offices in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us the story, the creation of Great Livin'. How did the project come to you?
The project came to both Steve and I. I've been a therapist, a behavior support consultant on the developmental disability waiver for the past 8-9 years, and met Stephen Nadolny through this, and we have been providing behavior support consultation to people with developmental disabilities, which means they have a diagnosis of mental retardation or a traumatic brain injury, cerebral palsy, autism, that group of diagnoses.
Yeah.
And I met Steve at this training, and I really liked, you know, the questions he was asking and things he was saying, and it dawned on me that we could better implement our philosophy as behavior support consultants if we owned the residential agency. That way we could have more of a clinical-based stint on how the residential end of things is provided to these people.
Matt, at the time, were you dealing with others, in other words, property owners, and putting your clients, patients into these facilities?
Well, they're not really my patients per se. The way that the system works, the way the developmental disability waiver works in New Mexico, is the individual receives money through Medicaid, which the DD waiver is a carve-out. It's a carve-out of funding that is provided to these people with those diagnoses I described earlier. Mm-hmm. And basically, the waiver, what they're waiving is their right for institutional care. So the DD waiver is the state's answer to institutions, and really is designed to provide wraparound services to people with developmental disabilities and incorporate them into mainstream society.
Okay.
So with that carved out money that they get based on their level of need, they can get residential care, they can get any therapy under the sun, from behavior support consultation to physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, vocational services to help people find jobs and getting them out in community, dayhab type services. Once again, just integration into the community is what fuels and pushes all of the services.
Yeah.
So what it was before is I was, as a behavior support consultant, basically I was seen as an ancillary support, and I would come into other agencies, such as the one that we started, Great Livin', and offered suggestions, made recommendations. Hey, I think this plan would really help this individual get through the day because of a lack of cognition or because of tendencies in frustration, whatever the need may be. I would come in and train some other agency, residential agency staff.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I'm sorry, please continue.
Oh, so they would either accept my recommendations or not. And so having control, being the boss of the residential agency, we can create the infrastructure based on our clinical ideas.
Got it. It integrates the facility with your expertise, and what a great opportunity for you to implement what used to be suggestions. Now they actually become policy for your group at Great Livin'. Give us a sense of sort of how the property piece works. Are these single-family homes? Are they multi-units facilities where the folks you're helping live? Give us a sense of that physical piece.
This could be your next-door neighbor. The houses and apartments and wherever these individuals choose to live. It occurs in several ways, but basically it is mine or your house, and either individuals already live there and they just need the staffing, which we refer to as coaches. Up to 24 hours a day, we provide transportation, we provide support, you know, help with medication administration. We provide anything you would need for everyday living.
Yeah.
We can provide. And It occurs either in their own homes or homes that we help them find.
So you have a lot of employees, I'm guessing, or freelance 1099. Give us a sense of the human capital. What does it take to put a group of folks together and tell us who's working for you and how you work with people?
Sure. It really varies based on the individual's level of need. Right now, I think we have a staff totaling 23, 24, something like that. And we have, I think, 9 clients that we're serving.
Okay. So that gives you a sense of how 24 hours kind of spreads over 9 clients. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
From the entrepreneurial perspective, Matt Paul, how did you and Steven initially fund this startup?
Out of pocket. I don't know if that's what a grassroots company would be defined as.
You'd call it a bootstrap, I think, is the technical term.
There you have it. Yeah, Steve and I started it with our own money. We had either savings or pulled money out and started it.
You do own the properties, right, or you mortgage them?
I have one right now, soon to be 2 properties that I own. You're right, like you said, that the bank and I own together. But that isn't the only place that the people we serve live.
Okay.
They live in other homes. Like I said, if they are not forced to just live in those homes. Those are just options. One of the main pushes that we have is to really push person-centered service, which goes from paying attention to how people wake up in the morning to where people want to live, who they want to live with. Do they want to learn how to ride the bus, or do they, you know, they're not there for that? I mean, we do push independence as that is another one of the driving forces. But all of our services really, as best we can, try to focus on from a person-centered place.
When you and Steven started talking, did you feel that was sorely missing from the facilities you were working with at the time? That idea of person-centered?
I think that's where the DD waiver has been trying to go since New Mexico shut down the institutions, which happened in the late 70s, early 80s.
Oh,
there
wow.
was a big push, I think nationally, to really serve people with disabilities in a different way.
Mm.
And, you know, New Mexico's evolution, every state has its own particular evolution. And I think that New Mexico started in the late 80s, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and by creating the DD waiver, and it's going more and more in that direction. But I mean, based on our starting point, where it was institutional care, which is a very medical model and very globalized care for a lot of people, it's not really individualized. I think we've come a long way, and so I think that finances and policy, state regulations and stuff are moving forward, but they also cause hindrances. They create their own dynamic that we have to work around.
We're visiting with Matt Paul. He's the executive director of Great Livin'. It's a unique supported living program that he co-created with Steven Nadolny. When you talk about policy and you talk about all the headwinds that state governments, city governments are facing now, what are your biggest worries moving forward with Great Livin'?
Oh, obviously, the finances. Are they going to make budget cuts from a system that is already at bare minimum? I think a lot of the issues that arise from residential in particular, because it is a 24-hour service and it does take a certain level of skill and knowledge base to perform, not having funding to pay employees appropriately or to provide benefit packages, those types of things, so that we can continue to serve effectively.
Yes.
Are always, there are obvious concerns.
Yes. Well, for all businesses, but particularly, let me ask, are most or all of your revenues coming from the DD waiver, or are there other sources of revenue in your mix?
We are right now exclusively receiving money through the DD waiver. There are other waivers. There's a MeVia waiver that has its own standards and set of guidelines to abide by that people with disabilities can receive service money from, that we have served in the past and we'd serve again. Our office is located in a business incubator, West Enterprises, that has been very instrumental and continues to be instrumental in helping us come up with other ideas on where maybe we could receive either actual money or services and benefit packages for our employees and for the clients, the people that we serve.
Extraordinary work you're doing at Great Living. This idea of community is huge for the way you administrate your program. I know that from the materials I've reviewed. A lot of extracurricular activities that get worked into your clients' lives. Tell us a little bit about the range of activities you help them participate in.
Sure. I mean, again, it is very person-centered. And the funny part is that the sky is the limit. We have people that are involved in remote control car clubs to collecting baseball cards to working at Sunflower.
Wow.
The push is always to encourage and teach and show, create opportunity for age-appropriate stuff. I think for a very long time, people with disabilities, in particular people with a diagnosis of mental retardation, have been seen as kids. And, you know, a 45-year-old person with mental retardation has very different needs than a 5-year-old, even though they may react in similar ways in certain circumstances. Mm. Their needs are very different, and the way they view the world is very different. So instead of, you know, being accepting of playing with Legos, it's, no, let's go out and, I don't know, try to get a job at the Lego factory, something along those lines.
Yes, yes.
But we don't have a Lego factory in Albuquerque. That's just an example.
Matt, as you and Stephen look at your company, do you have a growth plan? I mean, what does it look like down the horizon for you guys as you continue to evolve as a company, serving your current clientele, which I'm sure is paramount? But is there a growth trajectory to this idea?
Sure, there sure is. And that's always evolving also, I'm sure you can imagine. But when we first started out, our business plan started off with opening 2 houses, providing care to 2 to 3 new clients per house per year. So that would be 4 to 6 new clients per year, up to about 36 individuals, which would equal roughly 12 houses. In addition to that, there are other services that we are going to provide. One is behavior support consultation to help us implement in a more mainstream internal fashion the clinical stent.
Ah.
And in addition to, and the other service that we would provide is supported employment and job developing.
Mm.
I think those 3 services really go hand in hand with providing a clinical avenue on how to encourage independence and teaching skills in a clinical concept versus just kind of shooting from the hip. And we can, you know, Steve and I, having our backgrounds as clinicians, can kind of tease that out, who we would hire for that type of job, the direction that we would want to take, what type of avenue would we want to take, like a strict behavioral kind of stint or a skill-based type of intervention. And then in addition to that, really having a sector of Great Living be focusing strictly on creating relationships in the community and in even outside communities that is pushing the word for, hey, what about including people with developmental disabilities in your business? Having job opportunities and creating relationships so that we can open the door at least for the people that we serve.
Well, it's extraordinary work you're doing. Great Living is the company. We've been visiting with Matt Pohl. He's the co-creator and executive director. His partner, Stephen Nadolny. Matt, congratulations on the progress you're making with this model and also the extraordinary work you're doing for the community and for these individuals. The website is www.greatliving.com. Just like it sounds, greatliving.com, located in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Matt, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America.
The brain.
Camille F. Bishop, PhD, asks, why can't we all just get along? In her new book, We're in This Boat Together, she stages a dramatic whitewater rafting journey with 4 principal characters to illustrate and examine the profound differences between generations in terms of how they work, think, and lead. Camille is a career educator with about 30 years of international teaching experience, and she says that the face of leadership is changing in companies across America, and the stakes have never been higher. Joining us live on the line is Camille F. Bishop. She's the author of We're in This Boat Together. Camille, welcome to the Small Biz Brain.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be with you today.
So the book features four unique and very different characters who set out on this journey on a company, and the company's called Handover Company, which I love that. It's a team-building whitewater rafting trip, and so these four characters plus a guide who I know is pivotal. Why the rafting trip?
Well, I use the whitewater rafting metaphor because I think that transition is often very tumultuous, and I went on a whitewater rafting trip many years ago, and little did I know that it was going to be class 4 or 5 rapids, and it was so stomach churning. I thought, what better metaphor to use when you talk about leadership transition?
Is it about the danger and about the journey and about how fear crystallizes how relationships work?
Yes, and it's also about the challenges. You know, when you think about whitewater rafting, each rapid represents a unique challenge, and you have to really pull together to be able to make it through. And each of the four generations that are currently in the workplace have their own strengths and their own weaknesses, and if we can understand one another better, know where we're coming from, we can pull together better.
Right. So you have four principal characters. They're each representing, as you say, their own generation's unique style. Let's walk through the four main characters, Nate, Brianna, Brad, and George, and perhaps also the guide, and find out how you characterize each of these generations and, of course, the characters.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Well, we'll start off with George. He's a member of the Silent Generation, and George's generation came along right after the World War II generation. They are very traditional in their approach to the work and leadership. They tend to be quite frugal and financially conservative. They have very defined gender roles. They certainly didn't grow up with computers, and they're very value based, very moral people. Then you've got Brad the Boomer, and of course that's my generation, so I had a lot of fun working with that particular character. And
oh, yes.
Brad is the kind of guy that he's also very loyal, very responsible, willing to work hard, but he's also certainly thinking about retirement, whereas George, he just wants to keep on working.
Mm.
And then Brianna is the Gen Xer, and she's trying to juggle the demands of home and family life as well as the workplace. She and her husband have more of an egalitarian type of marriage where they're sharing responsibilities. And then we've got Nate, the millennial, and Nate is totally into the internet. He's very savvy, able to multitask, but much more interested in relationship and in negotiating what he will and won't do.
Fabulous. Now, it seems that Danielle is a very pivotal character. At least I felt that way. How did you think about her role as it relates to this entire journey?
That's really an interesting question, David. Daniela, of course, is a Swiss-German rafting guide, and I think I picked her character because I lived for 5 years in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And I remembered very clearly how direct that particular culture is and I felt like I needed a rafting guide who would be very directive and who would be able to get them through the journey.
Mm. As I look through page 107, you say, for the millennials, this is a no-brainer, relationships rule.
Right.
So as you progress through the four generations and thinking about them, how important is the value of relationships for each of these characters relative to the work itself?
Well, for each one of them, relationship is important, but I think that each generation is unique in the way that they draw the lines. For example, in George's generation, you go to work, you come home.
Mm.
And work is work, and home is home, and they really made a pretty clear distinction between those two places. And especially in regards to leadership, they didn't expect their leader or their director or manager at work to have that much of a personal relationship with them. That just wasn't part of the scenario.
Yeah.
You come down to the boomers, it's pretty much similar. The boomers, of course, were the first generation to say, don't trust anyone over 30. More cautious of leadership.
Yeah.
Then you come down into the Gen Xers and the millennials, and relationship starts to become extremely important, Partly because I think we've undergone so many societal changes. These two generations have experienced an escalating divorce rate. A lot of times these younger workers have grown up in homes where the father figure perhaps was absent or not totally emotionally there, and they are really looking for a sense of family. And for them, relationship is everything, on the job and off the job. So I think that is actually one of the really unique differences between the generations in the workplace today.
We're visiting with Camille F. Bishop. She's the author of We're in This Boat Together. Camille, do you have a website that you'd like to point us to?
I'm actually working on a website, and that website's address is CamilleBishop.com, and it's under construction.
Okay. When do you expect it to go live so we have a date reference for this podcast?
I hope it to go live by March 1st.
Okay. Thanks for that. March 1st, 2009, folks. Let's get into transition a little bit. What does an organization really need to understand about itself in order to facilitate a successful transition of leadership, and then given the overlay of the multi-generational approach that you've taken to this story?
Well, I think it's very helpful when an organization, first of all, understands its vision and where it's going into the future, and whether or not that vision, perhaps the original vision, has actually changed somewhere along the line, and they need to really recognize that. And secondly, they need to understand that there are generational differences in the way people perceive leadership. And from that perspective, when you're thinking about a leadership transition, they need to understand, well, how am I going to bring everyone into this process? So if you've got older workers, say in their 60s or 70s, that's more of the silent generation, which is represented by George, they're pretty much used to just taking orders, don't ask a lot of questions, automatically trust the leadership, whereas your younger workers are not coming from that place at all. They want to be included. They want their voice to be heard. They want to be more collaborative. And they want to have a sense that someone really cares about their voice.
It sounds as though the tone of all of this, or the spirit, is that no way is better or more effective than the other. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a very fair statement, David. It's not really about one way being better than another. It's about understanding that there are many different ways to approach leadership, and that the generational piece has come in with the way society and culture was when that generation grew up, and that has shaped a lot of their perceptions about leadership.
So for an individual, the challenge, I suppose, is to really understand that you're grounded in a zeitgeist, a certain time period that shaped how you think, and then to come into empathy so that George can appreciate Nate. Is that more or less how this shapes up?
That's exactly right, David. I like that term zeitgeist because that's exactly what it is, in a sense. Many people really are skeptical about the whole issue about generational differences. But if you go to the research, especially in sociology, you'll see that it's been a prominent topic since the 1800s, and that is that certain historical events happen in each generation, and it actually can have such a formative effect on them that it shapes a particular way of thinking that actually can last their lifetime.
Tell us what other activities you're involved with. Are you continuing to write? I know you were an educator. Are you still active there? What kinds of things are you working on?
Well, actually, I'm really interested in writing another book along the same lines, except looking at culture and leadership rather than generations in leadership.
Mm-hmm.
When I did my initial research, I actually did both variables in the research, but I just narrowed it down to one when I wrote this particular book. But I'd like to also write one related to the difference in leadership perception based on culture, because I think this is another huge challenge for us in the global economy that we are facing and the global business world that we're living in right now.
We are seeing a marked increase in diversity in the workplace, aren't we?
Absolutely. And it's not going to go away. Globalization, I mean, if anyone's read the book The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman,
yeah, it's wonderful.
This is the trend. You know, and the world has flattened itself in the last 5 to 10 years. You've got India, China has come full force into the global workforce, and that's just only going to continue. So the diversity is only going to increase, not decrease.
Is there a way that small business owners or leaders within maybe mid-size or even larger businesses can help facilitate the kind of empathy that this story illustrates?
I think so. I think a lot of it has to do with just good, honest communication, having opportunities for people to discuss these potential differences, perhaps potential tension points. But that doesn't mean that we have to build barriers against one another or label one another or create stereotypes. I think communication, honest communication that builds trust and that helps us understand one another and work together more effectively is so important. I think one of the books that really inspired me to write my book is called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and the greatest dysfunction is not having any trust among one another.
Mm.
And I think that's the part of the key of helping us become more empathetic towards one another.
Yeah, we've learned that trust makes markets, trust makes cultures.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. The book is wonderful. Stories can do so much. It's called We're in This Boat Together. I've been visiting with Camille F. Bishop, Ph.D. She's the author of the book. This is available where, Camille?
Well, you can get it on many different places on the Internet. Probably the number one place would be Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's also available at Borders.com, BarnesandNoble.com, BooksAMillion.com. So it's not in the bookstores. You know, today, in today's publishing world, you have to have a lot of upfront financial resources to get your book in the bookstore, and
yes.
I'm a first-time author. But on the Internet, you can find it.
Terrific. And if you're listening on smallbizamerica.com, there'll be a link as well to the Amazon, so you can buy it right there from the post. Camille, thanks so much for a rich segment around this important subject. Camille F. Bishop, and that's at coming soon. Camille Bishop, that's C-A-M-I-L-L-E, Bishop.com in March of 2009. That site will be live. Thanks so much for joining us on the Small Biz Brain.
Thank you, Dave.
Small Biz America.
The Brain.
This podcast is produced by Small Biz America.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America. Thanks for listening to the West Enterprise Center Start and Grow Your Business podcast. For more information, visit us at west.org.